Welcome to the Speaking Podcast. You can find all our episodes on speakingpodcast.com. We're also on BitChute and YouTube Speaking Podcast. I also have the Awakening Podcast, the Meditation Podcast, and the Learn Polish Podcast, and all can be found on roycollin.com. Today, my guest, all the way in St. Petersburg, in Russia, not in America, please welcome Michael Wader.
Thank you very much, Roy. I'm happy to be here and looking forward to today's presentation. So I'm interested in hearing what kind of questions you have and what kind of answers I can come up with. We'll see what happens.
Exactly. Well, first of all, I'd always like you to introduce yourself to the audience.
Certainly. As Roy said, my name is Michael Wader. I am an American, but I've been living in Russia for a number of years now. I did 25 years in the military, American military, and then I started my own business called Leadership Excellence International 25 years ago, and I've worked in 18 different countries with that company, teaching leadership and lean technology. Those are my two focuses. But primarily in the last several years, there's been more leadership and less lean because we found there was a need for that. I'm a Toastmaster in four different countries, and I'm an author of six different books, and I just enjoy life. So I'm working on my third, about three and a half career, I would say. I'm getting ready to start my fourth one this summer. But life throws a lot of things at us. We just meet those challenges and keep changing like a chameleon. We just keep changing to meet the needs that we have to survive. So that's a little bit about me.
Brilliant. I'm interested in this because I wasn't aware that you were in Toastmasters as well. So that's a good one. I know that from the military because anybody that I know that came from a military background, they're fantastic business mindsets, whatever they go through. But what I'd like before you go into that is, prior to that, where you're, you know, how were you in school? I always like to know the person's journey of how they actually became competent speakers.
Well, I'm going to tell you a little anecdote first to get you started. In school, especially in high school, I talked all the time, constantly, and it got me in trouble in school. Teachers used to send notes home to my parents saying, Michael is talking too much in class. He needs to pay more attention. So before, I used to get in trouble for talking in class. Now they pay me to speak in class.
Brilliant. You were practicing.
I was practicing, getting ready. I've been talking since I've been a young boy, and most of the time it doesn't get me in trouble. When I was in the Vietnam War and we were in the jungle, I had to practice being quiet because if you talk a little bit too much there, you're liable to get shot. So I had to learn to be quiet. It was very difficult for me. And when I went into my own company in 1995, I found that I talked too much to the customers. I was talking, telling them all about what we could do, how they could improve, what could be better, and I wasn't making many sales. And then an old mentor of mine, I had two mentors at that time, one of my mentors said, Michael, you need to talk less. You need to listen intentionally. Use intentional listening to find out what they want, and then once you know, then you can ask them if they want to buy, or if you listen long enough, they may tell you they want to buy. So I tried that, things got a whole lot better, and my business took off, and the rest is history. I've been trying to listen to customers and then give them the answers they're looking for the last 18 years around the world, and last 25 years around the world in 18 countries, and it's been working great. So I just find that talking for me is very comfortable. And there are times when I need to talk a lot, and there are times when I need to listen a lot. And I find the better listener you are, then the better talker you are, the better speaker you are by having better listening habits.
Very good. And I think that the fact that you've been, you know, in a war, which, you know, obviously is frightening, but that makes you, you know, fearless to anything else after that.
Everything else is easy. People tell me that we have problems, just like with the COVID virus and everything else we've had. It comes and goes. I mean, you just, unless you've been laying on your belly in a rice field and bullets flying over your head, if you haven't experienced that, then everything else might seem scary. But after that, there's not much that's going to scare you.
Exactly. And so you said is it in four countries that you're in Toastmaster or four clubs?
No, four clubs in four countries. I'm in a club in Singapore. It's an advanced club. I'm at a club in Doha, Qatar, which is an advanced club. I'm in a club in St. Petersburg, which is a beginner's club, a young one that I'm helping to nurture and help them, mentor them and so forth. And then I'm in a club in Toronto, which is another advanced club. So I'm in three advanced clubs and one beginner's club.
You obviously love it. So how long have you been doing the Toastmasters?
Well, that's another funny story, Roy. I started in 1986. I needed to change my career back then in the military. I needed to change the direction I was going. I was too tough of a manager and not doing well. So I decided I needed to learn how to speak to people. So I joined Toastmasters in 1986, stayed in it until 95, got out when I started my own business and started traveling so much. And now I was out for 25 years and I just re-entered in February of 2020. So I'm just back in about a year now. And in the last year, I've given 51 speeches and joined four different clubs. And I'm doing it to knock the rust off. I find as a person, as you grow older, I'm a little bit older than you. And as you grow older, there may be some talents or some things you did when you were a little bit younger, but you haven't done them for a long time. And maybe you need to knock the rust off, you know, hit the old brain, knock the rust off them and get sharp again. So that's what I decided to do. I decided to get back into Toastmasters. I knew it from before. It has changed a lot, but I knew that Toastmasters would help me. I got back in it, been knocking off the rust, and things are going uphill. So I'm getting back into the speaking mode again and really enjoying it.
Brilliant. I know that one of my friends, he'd won, I think it was a humorous competition in Poland. And then he kind of got cocky and took a year off, 2 years off. And then he came in and it was like, you know, you forget, you think you come back at the same level. And it's like anything in life.
That's right. You have to maintain the level of performance. That's why most athletes, when they get involved out of college, they're about 22, 23 years old, and they're only good to about 35 or 40, and then they're done. They have to stay at it for those 10, 12, 15 years and work very hard every day at it. And then when their body doesn't allow them to participate or perform at the level they were before, it's time to retire. But if they take, like you say, take a year or two off, it's terrible trying to come back. It's just very, very, very tough. And I think it's that way in almost anything you do. It doesn't matter if you're cooking or you're driving a car or something else. You take a long period off, as I did 25 years out of Toastmasters. When I came back, I made a lot of mistakes at first and I had to knock the rust off. Because I used to be an award-winning speaker, and you just mentioned it. I'm in the district finals now for a humor contest in Doha this year, and I'm in the Table Topics final in Singapore this year at district level. So yes. I've been knocking the rust off, and we'll see what happens.
Brilliant, brilliant. Yeah, I've got into the humor speech district it was five countries about 2 years ago. And it's nice to go through because, you know, you have to win at your club. Sometimes the club is one of the hardest ones because...
That's right.
Yeah. It's a fun and like, you know, the way the journey changes, your speech changes because you're constantly, well, the way I was doing is getting feedback. And then just improving. And if you look at your speech from the very first time to club level to when you get to the district, I don't know about you, but I often say, why didn't I try to prepare my speech like that from the start?
That's right. And I think if we're open to feedback, which we should be, if we're open to feedback and ideas from so many upper level Toastmasters and other good speakers who give you very good feedback, you should think about putting those things in. You probably won't use all the ideas, but you may use a few of them, and it's going to refine your presentation. I know last year's world champion, Michael Carr, he did a speech called Blue, and he was talking about a lady who had some blood problems and her skin was always blue. He took that speech from club level all the way to the regional finals and semifinals of the international competition, and then changed an entirely different speech for the finals and won.
I think you have to, don't you? I think you're not allowed to use the same speech, but which is good because that's showing that you have the skill level to actually.
That's right. So he took it all the way to the semis with the same speech and then cut it off and come up with a totally new one and won. So it's quite a challenge when you get to that level. I'll do that next year. I'll get to that. I'll go there next year. This year, I'm not in the international competition this year. So,
and is the club in Russia online, or are you able to meet in person?
No, all my clubs are online. The one here in Russia was meeting face-wise until March of 2020, and then they went online. And now the plan is It looks like the 1st of June, they're going to start meeting again. But that's the plan. We don't know what the outcome is going to be because we still have to wait and see what's happening with this virus around the world. So, but right now the plan is in June, they want to go back live again.
Yeah, I miss the live meetings and all, as nothing beats it.
They're a lot of fun.
Yeah, exactly. And how do you prepare your, I mean, obviously you've got fantastic experience, the fact that you've got into the, you know, the final of district. So how are you preparing it? How do you practice your speeches?
Well, for me, I have a routine that I go through. Whenever I generate a new speech, I sit down and write it. It takes me about 4 pages, about 1,200 words. And then I scrub it down the second time. I leave it alone for maybe a week or so. Then I go back and I scrub it down again, get it down to around 850 to 900 words, which is about 2.5 pages. Then I leave it alone. I go back a third time and I scrub it down to around 750. Once I get it to 750, I print it out. Then I'm going to practice it. I'm going to read through it just to see if I got time. You know, you're only going to get 5 to 7 minutes. So I see, do I have my time frame down with this number of words? And then once I know I'm close, then I start marking up those 750 words. Wherever I want to put a pause in, I get my yellow highlighter and I put the word pause, 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 pause. I write all those things in my written script. And then I also, if I have something where I want to accentuate, like I want to say that it's very long, and I want to make sure I get that long, I actually write L-O-O-O-O-O-N-G so that the word printed is very long, remind me, and I highlight it. Once I have those highlighted things down and I got my time relatively down reading the script, I take the script and basically throw it away. What I'm going to do is take maybe 6 or 8 postcards, and I'm going to just make one note on each postcard, my opening, my closure, and maybe 3 or 4 things in the body that I want. And that's all I have is maybe 6 cards. Then I'm going to practice my speech with those 6 cards. After I have done that maybe 10, 15 times, I get rid of the cards, and I do it without any cards or any words, any notes, just straight into the screen. And I probably practice this, I don't know, another 10 or 15 times live, recording each time and watching it afterwards so that I can identify what I need to improve. And then usually if it's something like the competitions, not a regular speech, then I'm going to call a couple of my other Toastmaster friends. We'll do a Zoom. I'll present a speech. I'll get their live feedback. They'll give me some ideas, and then I go forward. So that's sort of my routine. Altogether, if I'm going to do a competition speech, it takes me about 4 weeks. If I'm going to do just a speech for the regular weekly meetings, it takes me maybe 3 or 4 days. So, and it's not all day during the day, but as I said, I write something and I leave it. And I write something and I leave it. And then I practice and I leave it. And I practice and I leave it. I don't try to just go all the way through like the last day for 8 hours. That's crazy.
Just, I know it's kind of different with the online because the cameras are turned off. And you're just talking to a screen, so you're just expecting people are going to. It's a weird, because I got into the division last year with that, and it was just a weird kind of feeling, because you know you can see how people are reacting normally, but also when you were physically at speeches, because when you allow at a club, like say a laugh, you know, you can just when you get to the division, laughs longer. So you don't want it to be too close to the 7 minutes. You need to kind of have a bit of a cushion, because you just don't know. You might make an assumption. Sometimes they're laughing at things that you don't expect them to laugh at.
Right. You're absolutely right. And also there's a problem, as you know, with online is cameras. You're talking to a little white light or a little white dot. You're not. So what I do, I think you can, you can see this. You see that?
Yeah.
That's a picture of me with my mouth cut off. If I turn it sideways, you see, it's a little pyramid. I slide that over the top of my computer so that open mouth is right where the camera's at.
Brilliant.
So now I'm talking to a person. I'm talking to a face. It just helps me to focus my attention on the camera itself, not on, because right now I'm talking to you, you're a little bit left and lower than the camera. So if I'm looking at you, I'm not looking at the camera. So I want to look at the cameras up here. So yeah. I just put that little picture up there with the mouth on it, and I'm talking to that person who's on top of the camera.
Brilliant. So, I've actually started doing, because at the start I was doing I'm not sure if it looks like I don't look at the camera, but I'm looking at you, but it's not. Before, I used to have the full screen, so I'd be looking like that. Right. But what I've done is I shrink it up now so that you're on top. So I'm actually looking at you. You know, I'm not exactly looking straight at you like I did, but looking at you is close enough. And that's what I'm actually doing.
Too. Yeah, I find that also the thing you mentioned about laugh. I double my time where I used to have, if I'm doing a humor speech, when I come to those points where I think there should be laughter, instead of pausing for 2 seconds, I pause for 3 or 4 seconds. I'm actually pausing a little bit longer each time because you cannot see the audience. You don't know their reaction. So you try to put a little emphasis on it. If they don't laugh during that time, it's not so bad. It's just a little bit longer pause. But if they do laugh, they have a chance to laugh and then recover and follow along. So just adjustments you have to make. And I came back on February and gave my first speech in June after we had already started lockdown with computers online. So I haven't given a live speech in front of a live audience in Toastmasters now since 95. But I've been performing around the world doing other conferences, speeches, and so forth live all the time. But I didn't do it inside of Toastmasters. So I really love the stage. I love the live stage, especially with a bigger audience and a much longer speech. 35, 45 minutes for me is wonderful. This 5 to 7 is a little bit tough.
Yeah.
I prefer the longer ones.
I think, is it 18 countries that you said that you've spoken?
18 countries, yes.
So maybe what's the difference? Because obviously sometimes there's different cultures and everything. What have you learned from that?
I just had another eye-opening experience yesterday. I was in Thailand yesterday at a FedEx corporate club of Toastmasters. And I completely forgot, I don't know why, but I forgot about their understanding of English. Because in this Thai club, they have some Vietnamese people, they have Thais, they have some Chinese, they have some Indonesians, Malaysians, and they don't always attune themselves to the English language as close as they should. And I was talking, not at a fast speed, but I was using words in my vocabulary that they were very difficult to understand for these people. It was a challenge for them. So it's the first time in a long time that I didn't culturally adjust. Normally, I'm very cognizant of the fact that I need to make a cultural adjustment. If I'm speaking to Russians, or if I'm speaking to Malaysians or Singaporeans or whatever country I'm in, Brunei or any of them, I make sure that I think about that ahead of time. Also, the culture of them being Muslim or Hindu or Buddhist or whatever they are, you also have to think a little bit about that also, because the words you say may be not offensive in English, but they may be taken the wrong way in the other countries. Same way with gestures. You don't point at people in most Asian countries, especially like India, when I go there, you don't point it. You point at animals, you put your hand open to people. So it depends. And if you do like I do, I always stand up at my speeches, even online, I'm always standing. So if I stand up and then I'm moving my hands, I'm actually making gestures. I have to be aware of gestures in different countries. So I'll just give you a little tip, just for all your listeners also. If they want to speak internationally and they want to speak to international audiences, one of the best books they can buy is called Kiss, Bow, or Shake Hands. I'll repeat that. Kiss, Bow, or Shake Hands. It's a great book. It talks about all the business etiquette and meeting etiquette in I don't know how many countries are in there, maybe about 80 or 90 countries are listed in the book, but it talks about clothes and speech and manners and habits. It's really a super book.
Excellent. That's definitely one I'll be ordering soon. Yeah, that's good to know. And do you speak other languages? Do you speak like Russian? Have you spoken in other languages?
I give all my presentations in English. And I do speak some Russian. I do speak some Mandarin. I speak a little bit of Vietnamese. And what I tell people is that I'm going to present in English, but be careful about your comments in your native language. I just might understand. So I give them fair warning, but no, I do all my presentations in English. I'm not a linguist. I'm not a person that is completely fluent in five or six different languages. That's not me. I can get by. I can order a beer and a pizza go to the grocery store and things most places, but I'm not a linguist. I'm not going to learn the language and become so fluent. That hasn't been my focus during my life.
I've seen some of your videos. I'm not sure where they were, but a lot of the audience had the earphones on. So I've seen that where, you know, you've got translators for the different languages. What's like, is there different tricks that you need to be aware of when you're talking to an audience that half of them are, you know, speaking different languages, whether it's just one different language, but they've got the translator?
Right there. Yes. You need to learn how to speak in short bursts. And this is something that they do talk about in Toastmasters, but not many people practice it. You want to talk in short sentences, and it's great for podcasts also, because if I talk in short sentences, it's easier for you to cut and paste when you want to put it together. But if I'm just rambling on and 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 on, and on, you can imagine the translator who's doing live, sequential, same time, not sequential, consecutive training. He's speaking the same time I'm speaking, about two words behind me. And if I'm speaking for long sentences, his brain is really going around fast. I have two professional interpreters. One's been with me for 15 years and one with me for 9 years here in Russia, because most of the people here who've been my audience in the past in Russia do not speak English. It's getting better now. In the last 3, 4, 5 years, it's getting better. But when I first came here 15 years ago, there wasn't much. So these two interpreters are very, very good. And when we do a conference, they only go about 15, 20 minutes, and then they switch to the other person, and then another 15 or 20 and switch. Because if I'm on stage for an hour, for them to do a whole hour continuously is an awful, awful lot. But I have learned to speak with interpreters. So if I have to pick up a new interpreter, it's not so difficult for me as it might be for someone else, because I take in consideration what the interpreter has to do. And therefore, I keep it in sound bites, short sentence, short sentence, short sentence. So,
excellent. No, that's and I don't know how they do that job, to be honest with you. You know, if they're listening and they're just continuously repeating what I don't know what way their brain works, but it's incredible that they can do that.
Best practice they get, they tell me, is from television. They like to turn on an old American movie, listen to it, and while it's going on, they're speaking all the lines of all the people. So they just practice that. So that's one of the ways they practice, just keep going reading with the movie theater. So
I know that you've had some very big clients, you know. I had them written down there, like Intel, GS, Smackline, Beecham, AMD, Boston Scientific. A lot of people would love to be getting clients like that. Any tips for people that are kind of dreaming to have land these big corporations?
There's an old story about 1849 in America. We had our gold rush in California, and there was thousands of people who went to California for the gold rush. And there seemed to be this one old man who kept going to the bank and making deposits more so than other people. He'd make deposit after deposit after deposit, turning in gold, not large quantities, small quantities, but a lot of them. And when asked about how he got more gold than anybody else, his answer was, "I got more gold because I dug more holes." By that, I mean, you don't try to stay with one customer for your life. You don't try to have two or three customers. You need to have a broad spectrum of customers who at different times of the year are going to need different things from you, and you can service them and always be on the horizon for new customers. Now, my way of marketing, which I haven't had to do in 25 years, I've never marketed, it's all been word of mouth, is that I answer a call when somebody asks for help. People contact me on the internet, even before we had the social media. I had a website many years ago. People would come to my website and say, "Michael, we're interested in some training. Will you come to Russia? Will you come to Malaysia? Will you come to India? Will you come to, probably the most strange place I probably ever went to? Maybe Brunei, which was kind of strange going there." But people ask me for help. And when they ask for help, what I do, Roy, is that I look at my calendar, see when I have an open date, buy a ticket, and go. I don't ask for a contract. I don't ask for a guarantee. I don't ask for anything. They said they needed help. I show up to help. And I have found that that is one of the best ways to get into some of these bigger companies, because sometimes they're very short on time. They need a response and they need some help. They're looking for it. They're not quite sure where. You show up at their doorstep ready to help them. You have just taken a big burden off their shoulders already. And it's one of the ways they get in, is to answer the call for help. Because usually when somebody calls you for help, you, well, I have to look at my calendar. How much are you going to pay me? How many days are involved? What are you looking for? And my first question is, do you need help? And if they say yes, let's arrange for me to come visit. I'll be there on a certain day. And I don't worry about all the other things. Now, maybe that's not good business sense. I don't know, but it has worked for me. And it's one of the ways that I got into a lot of the bigger companies and the better companies, was by responding to their call for help.
Love it. Excellent. And you mentioned that, you know, you prefer 45, maybe an hour, speaking. How do you prepare that? What way do you actually structure, say, an hour speech?
I know my material better than anybody else. I don't use scripts. I'll sit down. If I'm going to do an hour speech, I'm going to sit down and do a similar routine as I mentioned to you earlier. I'm going to write myself some notes. I'm going to make myself a few postcards. And then after just a few times, I'm talking about things that I know in here and in here, in my heart, my head, my heart. You ask me anything about leadership, I can talk for hours, maybe days on leadership. You ask me anything about lean technology or the Toyota production system, I can talk for days on those. On those two topics, you ask me, I can go forever on them. So I'm not just making up something new for this particular conference. I will adjust it for their culture, for their specific needs at that company, if that's the case. But I know the subject well enough in my head that I can just sit down and talk about it. It's just something that I've been doing for a number of years, and so it's ingrained. And that's what I teach people when they want to be a speaker. First thing you want to talk about is you. And this is just real quick now. I'll give you about 30 seconds of advice here. If you're a new speaker, sit down with a journal. I don't have my journal next to me. I'm sorry, I'd pick it up. Sit down with your journal and ask yourself, when I was 5 years old, what's the first story I can remember? For me, it was sitting on the front lawn of my house as a five-year-old, making flower chains and necklaces with my older boyfriend's girlfriend. It was his girlfriend, and she sat on the front lawn with. That's my first story. Well, you start there, and then you go to kindergarten, then you go to elementary school, and then you go to junior high, and then you go to high school, then you go to college, then you get married, then you go to war, and then you get all along this way, there are stories. Sit down with a cup of tea or a glass of wine with your journal and just put one-liners. Don't try and write the whole story. Just one line about those incidents. Story, 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 story. And you get a whole list of them. Put it away. Go back in a few days, get it out again and look at it. Read all of them, and the ones that make you laugh, take your pencil, check mark, check mark, check mark. Those are the ones that you know in your head very well because they're about your life and they made you smile or made you laugh. There's your start. I mean, you know the story better than anybody else. As I said, nobody knows your story better than you. So you just get up and start talking about it because it's inside of here. You just have to recall it. But do the ones that make you smile first, and you're going to have much better reception.
Yeah, and I've even noticed that. Like, because, I mean, there's the humorous speech in the Toastmasters, but even the serious, well, the normal speech, it's always the humorous ones that win. For the international speech competition, there's always humor.
Absolutely. Michael Carr had 7 one-liners or things that made you smile 7 times. If you watch his award-winning one last year, and I watched it probably, I don't know now, probably 30 or 40 times I've watched it. And I actually went back and counted how many words he said. I also counted how many smiles he made, how many times that he took pauses, all these things just to get some ideas about what's required today in the world of speaking. And it was super. So.
And I actually have the lean management down. Here, lean technology. Is that like the 5S, is it? The Toyota?
5S is just one of 24 tools in lean, yes. It was done by the Toyota production system. starting in 47 and they finished about 1980. I say finished, it's never finished, but that's at the point where the rest of the world found out about it in 1980. And it is a way of being efficient. They had, after the war, they had so little of resources, no resources. I mean, electric, water, power, all these things were destroyed. So now they had to rebuild. And they, Japan has very, very few natural resources other than their people. So they chose to say, we will use our people's brains and our people's bodies to rebuild our country, and we're going to do it smarter. We're going to be very, very efficient. 5S, visual controls, quick changeovers, where they put parts, how they deliver, Kanban system, so many, many, many pieces of the lean technology. And they started building it up, and they applied it primarily at Toyota. Americans actually helped them in 1947 to get started with it. So it was actually started by some Americans who went over there to help them. But the Japanese are so smart, they made it much, much, much better. Far better than the Americans had at that time. And in 1980, we were just way behind in the automotive industry. So we started listening to them, and we caught up and started doing much better. And it got spread all over the world. When I arrived in Russia in 2004, there was very, very little lean at all, almost none. And so I started spreading it and wrote some books over here and got it going. And now there are a lot of people here are doing it. And out of curiosity, we actually found somebody named Alexei Gastev, who in 1927, after Henry Ford and before the Japanese, started doing lean technology in Russia in 1927. I found one of his old, old books, and all the rest of them had been burned and destroyed, but I got one of the books that was left over, and it reads an awful lot like the Toyota production system. If somebody wants to know more about lean, they need to think about that necessity is the mother of invention. You need to improve because you need to improve. Making things simple, making them easy to duplicate again for other people. All these things will help you be better. So that's what the Lean Toyota production system is all about. So I learned it in the military starting in 1965. In the United States, the U.S. Air Force was doing Lean already as early as 1965, but we didn't call it that. We had our names for everything was different, but we were doing the same thing. And then when I retired in 95 from military, I looked around the market to see what I wanted to do. And I, what's this thing called lean? And once I started studying it, I found out, hey, I already know this. I've been doing it for the last 26 years. So I just started working on that first. And leadership, of course, as you said, military provided a lot of leadership training. And so the leadership side and lean side, I've been doing it for a long time. You could say I've been doing it since 1965, but I don't know if it's really that long, but it's something like that.
And I've read a Henry Ford book, and you know, they were even on about the way the factories were changed around to use less people, less walking time. And we see the first that kind of that we're aware of that was.
Yeah. Henry Ford was the first when he started setting up the Ford production system in 1919. He wrote a book called Today and Tomorrow. And in that book, Today and Tomorrow, is where he described all these procedures and how he reused things and changed things and moved things. And I mean, and he was a little bit overboard on it. His parts of his engines would come to him in wooden boxes. He actually would take the wooden boxes apart and use the wooden planks for the floorboards inside the old Model Ts, reuse the wood. And then if the wood that got broken and couldn't be used, he took it out and back to the factory, and he had one of his employees start making charcoal. And he was one of the first charcoal manufacturers in America, was Henry Ford. And people don't know that, but he took his old wooden boxes and burned them wood. You don't burn it all the way to ash. You burn it until it starts getting dark and black, and then you cool it off. And that's your charcoal. so he was a very, very intelligent man. So the Japanese took his ideas and some other ideas from some other Americans and put them together and just made it a whole lot better. So.
And other than Henry Ford's book, you've written some books as well. So, like, is there books you'd recommend, or have you covered what we need to know in your books?
you never have everything you need to know. That's not you need possible. 100 of them. Not possible. This is one of the books that I have written called Leader of Change, and this book is focused on the fact that so many things have been changing in the world over the last 10 years and changing much, much faster. And the leaders don't know how to get their teams to accept that change. Because so many people, as you know, Roy, so many people do not want to change. They want more money. They want a better house, a better living, but they don't want to change. The Russian author Tolstoy said it the best. He said, everybody wants to change the world, but nobody wants to change themselves. So as a leader, you need to know how to help teams to change, change their methods, change their ideas. And where does it start? It starts with you, the leader, first. You never ask somebody else to change or do something unless you are willing to do it yourself. A very, very primary principle of leadership. That's one of two or three that are really, really important. You never ask your workers to do some job that you're not willing to do yourself. That doesn't mean you have to do it, but you're willing to if necessary. So don't ask them to do things that are impossible or too dangerous or whatever. You have to be willing to do them yourself. So I wrote that book, and it was fairly popular. It's on Amazon, and I started a new series of books. Looking Up is a book about branding yourself. In other words, if you're going to be a leader, how are you going to be popular? How are you going to, let's say you want to change jobs from one company to another company, how are you going to be the leader of choice? How are you going to be or you're in the same company, here's a worse situation, same company, but you get moved into a different department where they know you, but you're going to be their new leader. They've already got a preconceived notion about you before you ever arrive over there. So Looking Up is trying to help people brand themselves a little bit better. And then I follow that with Fired Up. And this is about getting your ambition and your motivation all lined up in the right direction so that you can light your fire. People often get bored, get tired, they've been the leader for 15, 20 years, or they don't know what else they want to do. They need to relight their fire. Their fire is gone. And they need to figure out how to relight that. So the second book. And I got two more books that are in the pipeline. And they're going to be part of a four-book series that I'm doing on just focusing on the leadership side of it. Just how do I become a better leader? What needs to be done? What can I do for me? How do I make Michael Wader or Roy Coughlin, how do I make myself a better leader first? And then how do I get people to follow me by doing the things, those actions that the leader needs to take?
Excellent. And I believe you've got one of them on your website, the Fired Up one, isn't it?
One's free. You go to the website, www.michaelwader.com, and right on the homepage, there's a free book there. So books are not the way I'm making all my revenue. That's for sure. But they are helping people. And that's what I want to do. Those people that I never see, those people that I never talk to, that I can't reach personally, they can pick up a book for free. It doesn't cost them anything. Download an ebook, download it and go through it. If it helps just one or two people, it's worthwhile. So I just put it out there and let it be. About every 9 months, I take down that book and I'll put up another book just for free, just so people can get a free book.
Nice. You got to help.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Not everybody does that. So I admire that. So fair deuce. Yeah. Brilliant. And
go ahead.
No, go on. Yeah.
There's a theory I have, and I pass it to everybody whenever I have the chance. I believe that all of us in the world, all countries, all people, we're in one boat. And when somebody goes down and drops their oar and can't row anymore, you need to pick up that oar and keep rowing. Because if we don't keep rowing, the boat's going to sink and we're all going to be gone. So everybody needs to help each other. Everybody needs to help everybody. And if we can just do a little bit of that, maybe that person with the oar only needs a 15-minute break to stretch or exercise or relax them. Go give them a break. Go help them for 15 or 20 minutes. Go do your little part, you know, and then get back and let them do it again. Or if they go down completely, take over their position and keep the boat going. Because if we don't keep the boat going, we're all going to sink. And I don't think any of us want that. I think all of us want life to continue. So we need to work together.
That's like the translator. Once one's done his 15, 20 minutes, he puts down the oar and the other fella starts rowing.
Same idea. And it's just the idea that if we help more people, we're going to be better off. And I'll give you another leadership principle. I said there was a few of them. The second one that I like to talk about is that if, as a leader, if you take care of your people will take care of the process. Just think about it during this last year and a half we've been in this lockdown now. Our people had to go home, many of them working from home. They're not in the office. They can't walk down the hallway to the water cooler and talk to their friend because they're at home. You know, they can't go to a meeting because the boss is having a meeting about some changes in the company. They can't go participate because they're at home. Many people who are at home are feeling left alone. They feel like they're missing out things at work. If you're the leader and you're contacting them every day, doesn't mean the top leader has contact 200 people. He can delegate that to other managers, but every employee needs to be contacted every single day and somebody talk to them from the company. Let them know what's going on. Do they have any needs? Do they need to get a vaccination? Do they need to get medication? Do they need to get their child in school? Do they need some kind of help with their home? What do they need? These are your employees. You're responsible, so take care of them. If you do that during this time, and then after the virus is over and people all come back to work, what kind of employee are they going to be? You've been taking care of them for the last year and a half. They're going to appreciate that. You kept the company alive so it didn't fold. Now they're coming back and they're going to give you 110%. They're going to work better than they did before. So if you take care of the people will take care of the process. Don't try and be a micromanager and take care of everything yourself. You take care of the people's needs and let the people who are the experts currently, let them do the job. Many leaders used to do the job 15 years ago, but they've been promoted up, 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 up. They still think up there that they know the job. They don't. The people down here doing it now know the job. So you take care of the people will take care of the process just like you did 15 years ago.
Exactly. And I wish all the corporations would kind of take that advice, because what I'm seeing with a few, they're taking benefits away from people. Like they used to have, you know, different, if they go to gyms, I know some of the gyms are closed, some aren't, but they're taking away all the benefits from them. Yeah. That's not what you do. You look after your people, and your people have your back then as well.
That's right. You take care of them and they'll take care of you. And I know Simon Sinek, who is now one of the more popular management gurus, is talking about servant leadership. Well, Ken Blankenship did that for many, many, many years. He was talking about servant leadership, and now Simon Sinek has picked it up. You are the servant to the people who are serving the customers. You're not serving the customers. You're serving the people who are serving the customers. And if you think that way, it's going to be much better for your company.
Absolutely. And I know, just finally, actually, I've seen as well that sometimes people, they kind of promote the wrong people. You know, so I just like to hear your thoughts on that one.
Well, that's an easy one. That's a very simple one. We had it happen in the military all the time. We promote people until they become incompetent. We take our best technician and make him a foreman. We take our best foreman and make him a supervisor. We take our best supervisor and make him a manager. We take our best manager and make him a vice president. Each time we're promoting him up, 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 we're not giving them adequate training to be ready for the next level, to know how to take care of the people, to know what to do in the corporation. So we just keep promoting them until they become incompetent and then fire them or let go of them. Yeah. Why? I'll give you the military example. If you're going on a mission, why would you take your best sniper and put him in charge of the team? That's not what you want. You don't want your best shooter in front charge of the team. You want a team leader or whatever, and the sniper is one of the members on the team. You don't take your best and put him in a leadership role. Come on. But we do it time after time after. Matter of fact, I've got a whole speech I give on that, and it starts out very quickly. It starts out that every day in America, more than 1,000 competent workers are promoted, and then they fail, and it's not their fault. That's the first line in the speech, because it does happen.
No, I've seen it, because I worked in the construction industry for a mechanical contractor, and it was like the best fitter, the best plumber, the best tradesperson, oh, he becomes the charge hand, then the foreman. Eventually, they get stressed out, they fail, and they fire him. And it's like, ooh. Yeah. So what you've just said is it's basically back to the leader. he should ensure that he, you know, creates the training before they get the promotion so they're totally ready for it.
One of the other main principles of leadership is that you, as a leader, you should always be grooming your deputy, whoever your deputy is, your number two, or if you don't have a number two, the person you're expecting to step up to them, always be grooming them, giving them the opportunity to try something and fail now before they're the leader. Give them a small project, let them try it, see if they can do it. If they can't do it, teach them a little bit, but give them some advice. Let them have, make a few mistakes now before you start promoting them up to another position and they make a bigger mistake. So the best story about that is an old, old story. It goes back about 50 years ago when IBM was a smaller company. It was still one of the largest in the world, but it was much smaller than it is now. Somebody went out and made a mistake and they lost a $2 million customer. Well, many years ago, $2 million was an awful big customer. All the middle managers said, well, let's fire that guy, fire that guy, fire that guy. And the president of the IBM says, I can't fire him. I just spent $2 million teaching him.
Brilliant.
So we need to think about our deputies, our people right below us, and train. Just like an example, your podcast right now going on. Yeah, I heard you mention you had several. If you were got sick, if you went down for a period of time, weeks or months or whatever, Lord forbid that should never happen. But if it did, who's there to pick it up? Who's there to start running with it? Who's there to keep it going so that it doesn't fold or doesn't go away and your listeners still have somebody there who's going to carry on when you're not? I don't know what your business is right now, but that's what I try to tell corporations around the world. I talk to the president of the company, usually the CEO, or in Russia they call it the director general, the top person, and I ask them, what are you doing to groom your deputy? Well, I send him to school. No, that's not a good enough answer. What are you doing to groom him? Does he know all the roles that you have? Can he do some of your roles the same way? And there's a very good example. You can ask anybody about this, or they'll all agree with this. You have a director who has to sign certain forms in the company every day. Nobody else is allowed to sign them but the president of the company. Now, the president is going to go on vacation. So before he goes on vacation, he goes to his vice president or deputy and signs an official document that says now for this number of days, the deputy can sign these legal documents. He goes on vacation. When he comes back, what happened to his deputy? Did he all of a sudden get stupid? He has the skills. He has the knowledge to do those things. I'm not saying everything by law allows the president to not do it. Some things by law, the president has to do it. But many of the things the president of the company does, he doesn't have to. His deputy could do it. His deputy does it when he's on vacation. Why can't he do it when he's there? There's no reason for it. So I like to talk to people who are overstressed out. They say, Michael, I own the company and I'm the president of the top and I'm working 14 hours a day. Why? Why are you working 14 hours a day if you own the company? Come on. Find a deputy, find some other people. You don't have to control everything because many people think if they don't do it, it won't get done. That's not true. Find a good deputy, teach them.
Yeah. Stop micromanaging and you know, don't be afraid to hand the baby away because a lot of them want to hold on to their little baby and they don't want nobody else you know, minding the baby. So you have to, you know, if you want to really not let a business control you, that's how you have to do it. Find a deputy. I love that one.
Your example is perfectly right. And I have two daughters who are now 40 and 42 and I have four grandchildren and I have seen it in their eyes of my children and my own wife and then my own children who are girls. When they held the baby, it was great. But the first time they had to hand it to their husband to hold, make sure you get the hand there, make sure you support the neck. You know, they're so, I'm not going to drop the baby, come on. But the mother's very worried about you might not do it right. You know, and she says, I got to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning, give that morning feeding, right? Why? Why can't I get up and make a bottle if it's going to be a bottle? Why don't I get up and make it, you know? Well, you might not get the formula right. You might not do this right. You might not, you know, so they got to share.
Exactly. Exactly. Listen, Michael, it's been wonderful. I loved all the tips that you've given. And how can people get in contact with you?
Thank you, Roy. The people can contact me. I'm all over social media. So if you just put in my name, Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, and last name is Wader, W-A-D-E-R. Put that in any of the social media, you'll see my name pop up. You'll see places to meet me. If you want to reach me directly, my website is www.michaelwader.com. I keep it very, very simple. Just kept my name. I could use my company names or other names, and I decided not to. I just use my own personal name. So if they remember my name, just put that in, and they're going to see lots of clicks on it. Roy, are you in Poland now?
Yes.
Are you going to go to the Toastmaster meeting tonight that Gerardo is having?
And I think I've got a call. Yeah, so you're going to that one, are you? The leadership club.
I'm going to be going, and I'm going to be speaking tonight. So.
Oh, okay. I'll see if because I've got a temporary call, and it might be cancelled. So if it is cancelled, I'd love to go in.
Because they're having their 8th birthday, and it's their 8th birthday. They've invited me to come in and be the speaker for their 8th birthday party. So I'll be there in your country online by Zoom, and be speaking there tonight in Poland. So I'm looking forward to it. Gerardo's a super guy, and the club there is a very, very good club. I enjoyed meeting with them before, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I was a member of that club for about 3 years. So yeah, really enjoyed it. Yeah, so yeah, know all the guys there. So brilliant. So listen, thank you very much, and I wish you super success with both the division contests that you're in and in the future. So, yeah.
Thank you very much, Roy. And again, if your listeners want to contact me, just put my name in the media and you're going to come up with all kinds of hits. And if there's anything I can do for you or your listeners at all, somebody writes you and wants to contact your information, please pass them on to me. I don't charge for all that stuff. I give it away because we're trying to pick up the ore for each other. We're trying to help each other. So
beautiful. Love it. Yeah, I'll put the website in the description as well as on the video channels. So great. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very, very much. And I look forward to seeing you around the virtual world again.
Oh, for sure. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
That's all for the Speaking Podcast. You'll find all our episodes on speakingpodcast.com or on BitChute or on YouTube. Be sure to give us a thumbs up, share with your friends. Until next week, take care.